Blog Talk Radio.
Patriot Network. This is Dahl. I'm your host. We'll be joined here by Lori Ann, the host of the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann show. You can find that show right here at Blog Talk Radio on Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Sometimes they go into a bonus extra hour. We have a great show lined up for everybody. I want to thank everybody for finding us. It's such a privilege to be here. Today is Friday, November 11th, 2022. Let's not add too many twos to it. A shout out to our service members, both active and previous service members, our veterans. Today we salute you and honor you, your service, your sacrifice, your commitment to this beautiful country, the greatest republic on this earth. We owe our freedom to you. This broadcast would not be happening without your service in keeping this country free, and that's something that we will fight to do here from the Alaska Patriot Network, you know, one broadcast at a time. So everybody, thank you for joining us. We got a great show lined up for you, lots of information coming your way. I got a couple quick promos we're going to play, and then we're going to jump right into the show. So here we go, folks.
Tune in for the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann show, Sundays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. I promote liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you, and I hope listening to my show becomes part of your Sunday night routine.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day, helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help, and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
And you are tuned in to the Alaska Patriot Network. This is Dahl. I am your host. We're joined here by Lori Ann of the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann show. We're getting settled in here to our host seats. And I have a little Friday night tunes for all of you while we're doing that. So Love 'Em While You Can from Rain Johnson.
Whiskey finally caught up to him. Took the life right out of him. We were cracking jokes in the hospital room when the doctor said there was nothing he could do. I was mad as hell because he did it all to himself. And I spent more time judging instead of loving. Now I'm wishing I could get the time back, but time doesn't work like that. So love him while you can, 'cause life's too short not to give a damn. Love him while you can, 'cause you might not get a second chance to call up your mama, make sure she's okay, check on an old friend, 'cause life can get crazy. No one knows when the good Lord will take him by the hand. So love him while you can. Life had finally caught up to her. Second time around, cancer coming back to her. She was 16, the sweetest thing. Straight A's, just made it on the softball team. Her mama never left her side. Daddy, he was always working overtime, too busy making money instead of making memories. Man, he's wishing he could get the time back. All the time doesn't work like that. So love him while you can, 'cause life's too short not to give a damn. Love him while you can, 'cause you might not get a second chance to tuck in your baby, make sure they're okay.
Network. This is Doll. I'm your host. We have Lorianne with us. That was a little tune by Rain Johnson, Love 'Em While You Can. It's Friday night. Whether you're on the East Coast, the West Coast, or up in the frozen north, welcome to the show. So glad to have you. If you would like to call and join the discussion tonight, the number is 515-602-9722, 515-602-9722. We also have the chat open. So if you would like to join by via chat, we'd love to, you know, see your comments up on the board. Also, the call-in number is 515-602-9722. Press number 1, and that will show that you're wanting to join the discussion here on our studio switchboard, and we'll bring you into the show. So welcome, everybody. I want to welcome Lorianne in. Welcome, Lorianne. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, my dear. Always happy to be with you on a Friday night. Missed you last week. I know you were busy and you had lots going on, but it's just like, even though we've only done a couple of shows after your summer hiatus and everything, it still felt like weird not to be with you last week on a Friday night. I'm already gotten accustomed to being with you. So I'm glad that we are back this week, and I'm glad to be back on the show with you as always. And so much going on to talk about, I know, to get into.
Yeah. It's been crazy, and I took that hiatus to build our home. For those that don't know, I live in rural Alaska, and while we were away from home, a family of otters decided to take up residency. Well, they're all cute and cuddly, and if you just think about it, imagining them, but they're really stinky, filthy little beast, and they destroyed my beautiful home on the beach. And it wasn't so much a beautiful home, it's just a beautiful place to live, but it was my home nonetheless. The kitchen was pretty skookum, so we had to actually tear the house down because the smell was just so bad we couldn't abate it. So amongst all of the labor shortages and supply disruptions and shortages and everything else, we're managing to eke along and build our home. And last week, I had taken the summer off from the show to do this project, and because in reality, we didn't have sustainable internet that would sustain a broadcast like this. And I had tried it with a satellite connection. We hadn't, it was not acceptable connection. And along comes Elon Musk with Starlink. And I'm not like, oh, Elon Musk and stuff, but he put together a really great product. And I would say just about anybody in the community that, can afford one of these has gotten one for their home. And it is literally a life changer when you don't have cell phone service, which we all become accustomed to having pretty much anywhere, and then you don't have a Wi-Fi connection. It's hard for kids to do extended learning opportunities, or to study, or to work from home, or run a business, or to communicate with loved ones and stuff. So that is just been such a life upgrade for us. And on top of that, now we are able to stream TV too. So having, be able to watch movies and stuff on the internet and everything is pretty cool. And with the darkness and winter upon us, so thank you, Elon. He is making this broadcast available. And these, Lorianne, these Starlink dishes are amazing. I didn't buy the home package. I bought an RV package because the home package wasn't available yet, which is just perfect because I'm in the cabin and I'm not in the main house yet. But it's the size of a laptop computer, the disc is, the satellite disc. And it originally came with just like a little tripod stand. And what I was doing was finding a clear area outside the cabin and putting it on the ground and then putting bags of shopping bags with gravel in them so it wouldn't blow away in our little typhoons we have. And it will melt snow and ice off itself. It moves by itself and it tracks the satellite as the day goes by and stuff. It's amazing. And very, very affordable, very affordable. The unit, the satellite itself was $600, which, is less than an iPhone. And that included the router and everything to make it work. All we had to do was plug it in. And then, of course, subscribe to the service, which was way less than our previous service. So, this has just been so awesome.
Yeah, it still amazes me. It is. I know that it was always a challenge, in the past for you. And so it sounds like this unit is, you know, definitely worth every single penny for it, just to be able to have a reliable internet connection. And I love that it's, you know, travel friendly, like you said, so you can bring it with you wherever you're at. And yeah, it sounds really cool. So yeah, it definitely is an improvement. And you sound crystal clear as well. So it's great.
Well, that's great. And the irony of it is that this has been a huge challenge for families out here on the island for, you know, forever. I mean, well, you don't miss it when you don't have, when you go to town, you get a taste of everybody else's internet. We would realize what we were lacking. Well, Murkowski, this Rhino Senator in Alaska, you know, she pushed for this infrastructure and this fiber optics and all this stuff. Well, everything came a little too late. And it was ironic because they were, this big, huge fiber optic cable laying ship was just in front of my house a week ago, and they were laying fiber optic to connect to the island here. And, you know, everybody's, you know, messaging each other on their Starlink talking about this fiber optic that came too late, too little, too late. And even as they're laying it, you know, it's not going to be operational until 2025.
Yeah, that's way too long to wait. And then, of course, there'll be, delays.
But,
you know,
yeah,
they always love to have their delays.
But, of course, you know, the voters. Yeah, but the voters saw the cable being laid, you know, but a lot of them were like, woo, fiber optics on the way. And then we're like, oh, 2025, okay, well, you know, and I don't even know who's going to subscribe to it now, because the fiber optic they have on the other side of the island over, there's a village over on the other side, they have it, and it's not great at all. It was kind of right along the same lines of the stuff I was so happy to get rid of, this other satellite junk we had. But, yeah, so that's kind of what's going on here. And sadly, I missed your show on Sunday night. By the time we got done insulating and everything, it was just so late, and I had no voice. I had been masked up in an N95 to, you know, not because of the vid, not because of that, but just breathing fiberglass insulation for 5 days straight is just not optimal. I know it's not going to stop all the particles, but it's kind of slowed things down.
Yeah, that stuff isn't good for you to be breathing in. So yeah, there are legitimate reasons for wearing a good quality mask, and insulation is one of those reasons. Avoiding viruses, that is not a good reason.
Well, yeah, it's
like,
don't work. You know, a virus is going to, yeah, it's like a chain link fence trying to keep, you know, a mosquito out.
Exactly.
For viruses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you, yeah. Well, you know, put, if you put three chain link, you know, fences around, you know, back, then it might help prevent a mosquito from getting in, right? If you have triple chain link fence layers.
Even then it's questionable. But, you know, all right, so both of us are huge fans of Dr. Reality, also known as Dave Champion. And he's such an intelligent man. And if you've never heard of him and you'd like to follow him, he's on Rumble. And he's been deplatformed from just about everything. He actually does have a Facebook account and probably Twitter too, but it's Dave Champion, Dr. Reality. And we're going to play a clip by him. And, you know, he's, I don't always agree with everything he says, but, you know, I do find a lot of common ground with him. And He did an interesting take on the Paul Pelosi thing, and I know it seems like kind of old news, and we're going to talk about that tonight, just like we're going to talk about a little bit of politics, even though people are a little bit sick about that too. But hey, these are things that we have in front of us. But to me, listening to this clip earlier and while we were doing research and stuff, I saw a lot of parallels with past events and that led up to the current event with the Pelosi's and issues with security, not only at home, but in the Capitol and stuff. So I thought we'd give a listen to this Dr. Reality, a.k.a. Dave Champion clip, and hear his take on the Paul Pelosi thing. Right off the bat, I'm one of those people that's, you know, and I'm kind of leaning towards this still. He hasn't gotten me completely convinced that it wasn't a tryst, you know, a gay lover, drug-fueled something gone wrong, okay? I was still kind of, that was my first instinct, and it's kind of my gut instincts there. But right off the bat, in Dr. Reality video, he's like, you know, only a child in an adult body would come up with this conclusion. So that made me really want to listen to what else he had to say. So I think we should all give this a listen. Lorianne, what do you think?
I absolutely do. I mean, you know, with the elections, that's kind of taken center stage. And so this whole Paul Pelosi story is taking a back seat. And, you know, Dave Champion did this Rumble video on November 5th. And, you know, we haven't played anything from him for a while. So it's nice. And he did just get out of Facebook, I believe just yesterday. He had a 30-day Facebook jail. So he's back on Facebook, you guys. But, yeah, definitely follow Dave Champion on Rumble, and, you know, subscribe to him so that you get notifications when he puts something new up, because, you know, whatever he puts up is always very well thought out and very well researched and documented. And so, so he's definitely taking the time to pay attention to. So, yeah, I am all for playing this video from him. I am definitely ready when you are.
Well, he had me when he was like, okay, so only a child in an adult's body would believe this, you know, conspiracy theory, the one that I have. So I was like, all right, Dave, here we go. We're on, you know, we're going to do this, you know. Like I said, I have nothing but respect for this man. I mean, he's a statistician. He's a, you know, a trainer. He's a nutritionist. He's a financial IRS guru. He's written all kinds of books. He does his research. So let's go ahead and give this a go, and we'll be discussing this in depth after this. And if you would like to, a little bit of a Biden moment there. But anyway, so if you'd like to call in and join the discussion after the clip, the number is 515-602-9722. Press number 1. We'll bring you in. That'll let us know you want to join the discussion. And without much further ado, we're going to go right to this clip, and we'll be right back after this. Enjoy.
Welcome to the vodcast. The break-in at the Pelosi residence and violent attack on Paul Pelosi has spun all manner of theories about what really happened as opposed to the official government narrative. Today I want to discuss some of the inconsistencies in the official narrative. The Dr. Reality Podcast with Dave Champion. Let's start with this. I won't be getting into things like the childish claim that Paul Pelosi is gay and was planning to have gay sex with DePap. That's the kind of fairy tale spread by children in adult bodies. That said, some strange things have taken place concerning the investigation and the public statements by authorities. The question is, what do those inconsistencies mean? Are they proof that some deep, dark conspiracy is afoot to hide the truth from the American people? The answer to that is, as you'll see, part yes and part no. The three government assertions that appear questionable are these. Number one, Mr. Pelosi was able to make a phone call and speak in code so the dispatcher was able to listen to the conversation for a period of time, able to discern there was a problem, and dispatch officers. Number two, when the intruder broke into the house, his actions did not set off an alarm at the home, which seems inconceivable at the home of the Speaker of the House. And number three, police arrived at the Pelosi house, depending on what source you believe, in either 2 or 3 minutes. We'll start with this issue, number three, and then get back to one and two. Now, remember, if one buys the story that the dispatcher who was listening to the call sensed something was amiss, we have to ask how long it took the dispatcher to make that determination. Since no violence was occurring as the dispatcher was listening, I think it obvious she had to listen to some time before coming to the conclusion she needed to dispatch officers. Yet reports state officers arrived in 2 or 3 minutes after Mr. Pelosi made the call. That claim is highly dubious. Also, the call would not have been put out as a violent battery taking place because no violence occurred during the 911 call. The call would have gone out as an open line with no identified crime or as an intruder there now. The odds are very small either would have produced a 2 or 3 minute response time from the police. Now, let's consider point number one, that Mr. Pelosi was able to make a phone call without specifically telling the emergency operator that a stranger had broken into the house with a hammer, was carrying wire ties, and was looking for the Speaker of the House. The narrative is that Mr. Pelosi was able to go to the bathroom without Mr. DePape and call police from a phone in the master bathroom. Most of us don't have phones in our bathrooms, but the wealthy do. Some even have phones in their showers. My point being that that narrative is plausible, even though it's a nonsense story, and I'll explain why in a minute. Now, let's examine point number two, that DePape breaking into the home did not set off alarms. But before I jump into point number two, let me take a moment to ask you to subscribe to the channel, hit the like button, and share this presentation with everyone. Since this story broke, the public has learned the U.S. Capitol Police have live feed cameras watching the exterior of the Pelosi home. When asked by reporters if the Pelosi residence has a security system, San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins refused to address the matter. The government pays millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars, to think tanks and others to create scenarios on how to accomplish things like killing high-ranking government officials in their homes or kidnapping family members. The reason the government pays so much to have experts explore every conceivable way to accomplish such things is so the government can then develop countermeasures that will keep public officials safe. The Speaker of the House is the second in presidential line of succession, which brings elevated security concerns, obviously. Additionally, in the case of Nancy Pelosi, she is a lightning rod for right-wing animosity, in some cases rising to personal hatred. Security for the Speaker is provided by the U.S. Capitol Police, who have nationwide jurisdiction when protecting any member of Congress. When it comes to protection technology and physical protection teams, the Capitol Police receive ongoing training from the Secret Service and others. The Capitol Police and Secret Service work so closely that in D.C. they are informally referred to as sister agencies. In her position as the highest-ranking member of the House, Pelosi receives many security briefings, most unrelated to her, her home, or her family. But she is also briefed on threats against herself and her family. As such, she knows how much she is hated by the far right and how many people have been identified as having expressed a desire to harm her or members of her family. Because a Speaker of the House is far more in the political spotlight than is a vice president, protection of the Speaker is every bit as intensive and high-tech as is provided to the vice president. It's simply under the jurisdiction of the Capitol Police rather than the Secret Service. Do you imagine the vice president's home does not have an incredibly sophisticated multi-layered security network? Is the security system at the vice president's house shut down when the VP isn't there? Of course not. If somebody broke into the VP's residence when the VP was not home, would the Secret Service know about it? Yes, instantaneously. My point is that whatever is true for the vice president's residence is also true for the speaker's residence. even when she's not there? Would there be live stream cameras inside the home? Of course. Would there be microphones throughout the home? Again, of course. Would there be highly sophisticated motion detectors both inside and outside the home? Of course. Would there be glass break detectors? Yes. Would the agents who monitor and control those things at the Capitol Protective Security Bureau Central Command Center in D.C. be able to remotely lock and unlock various doors of the residence? Absolutely. Are there panic buttons concealed throughout the house that trigger an alarm in the command center when activated? Yes. Do these systems, whether at the vice president's home or the speaker's home, blare an alarm in the command center when triggered by an intruder or the principals? Yeah, you bet. The security measures I've just mentioned are not extraordinary. In high-end personal protection, they are merely the basics. When it comes to protections of officials like the president, vice president, and speaker of the house, there are more measures than those I've mentioned today. Let me share a brief story from about 30 years ago. I was training members of the protection detail for one of the wealthiest men in the United States. One of the measures they had in place at his 13-acre residence in Los Angeles was pressure-sensitive netting under every inch of ground that was not covered by concrete. If a person set a single foot on the ground anywhere on that 13 acres that was not covered by concrete, such as one of the several lawns or a flower bed, an alarm blared in the security command center, and an electronic map of the grounds covering most of one wall of the command center pinpointed and tracked the person's location in real time. That was 30 years ago. How much more sophisticated do you think things are today? Here is the key question. Would all these systems and others I've not discussed today be something Paul Pelosi would have to remember to turn on or turn off when entering or leaving the home? Or would those systems be under the control of the Protective Security Bureau Central Command Center? I assure you it's under the control of the DC Command Center. Did the Capitol Police know the instant DePapp approached the rear of the Pelosi's home? Yeah, absolutely. Did they know he was breaking into the house through the back door? Of course. Did they track him as he moved throughout the home? Absolutely. So, who do you think actually notified the San Francisco police? Paul Pelosi from his bathroom phone after the crime was well underway? Or the Protective Security Bureau's command center? Was there really a 2 or 3 minute response time by the cops? Or had the command center notified the police much earlier than the public is being told, such as when the exterior motion detectors alerted and they saw DePapp heading for Pelosi's back door with a hammer in his hand? Remember the initial reports that an unknown third person had unlocked the front door for responding officers? If the door audibly unlocked as the officers approached, would it not make sense they thought someone had unlocked it? And someone had. The responding officers just never stopped to consider that the someone who unlocked the door was 3,000 miles away in the command center. So why all the ridiculous stories spun for the public about what happened? Why don't just tell the public how it really went down? Because the specifics of the protective systems and protocols for high-ranking government officials are classified. It is a violation of federal law to discuss them with anyone not having the proper clearance, as it is to make statements that might reveal those systems and protocols. And the government has a vested interest in the public believing its security of high-ranking government officials is inept and unprofessional. Instead of saying no comment to virtually every question asked by the press, someone politically high up decided it was preferable to spin yarns to the public. Of course, when stories are fabricated to conceal the security systems and protocols, it is inevitable there will be the kind of contradictions and inconsistencies we've seen in the official narrative of the Pelosi attack. I thought it important to share how high-ranking government officials, such as Nancy Pelosi, are actually protected to dispel the kooky theories being propounded on social media. That said, it isn't unusual for the feds to hide the truth or spin yarns to mislead or misdirect the public. In fact, the federal government has been doing exactly that for 60 years concerning upon whom Congress has imposed the income tax. The truth is that Congress has never imposed the income tax on ordinary working Americans. You believe the income tax applies to you only because of a massive and successful federal government disinformation campaign to convince you that narrative is true. Here are a few questions I ask Americans who believe the government's disinformation campaign. In what title of the United States Code are income tax laws found? Can you cite the law that imposes the income tax on ordinary working Americans? What is the statutory definition of withholding agent in tax law? Tax law states that withholding agent is generally synonymous with another statutorily defined party. With whom is withholding agent generally synonymous? They are never able to answer a single question. Why? Because they've never read a word of tax law. They don't know anything. Instead of actually knowing something, they've simply chosen to believe the government's disinformation. That's how we do it in a land of liberty, right? We just blindly believe the government. You give them a chunk of your personal property every year because they tell you that's what the law says, and you never bother to see if they're lying to you, as they do about so many things. The good news is you don't need to spend years poring over income tax statutes, regulations, treasury orders, treasury decisions, revenue rulings, Supreme Court cases, and more. That's already been done for you. All you have to do is read one book to stop acting from a belief based on ignorance and start making decisions from actually knowing what the law says. One book that allows you to compare what the law actually says to the government's disinformation. One book that explains everything in a simple, straightforward manner all Americans can understand. If you prefer having facts and knowledge over blindly believing government, go to drreality.news, drreality.news, and grab yourself a copy of Income Tax Shattering the Myths. You have my word, it will be one of the most fascinating books you've ever read. I refer to the government's false income tax narrative as the largest financial crime in history perpetrated against you, the rest of the American people. Income Tax Shattering the Myths reads like a mystery. You know who's done it, but as you move through the book, you discover how they've done it. It truly is fascinating to see. I wish I could tell you the income tax scam is the only government disinformation campaign. Sadly, that's not true. Americans are the most chronically ill society in all of human history because of yet another massive government disinformation campaign, this one to make you sick and miserable by lying to you about human physiology response to macronutrients contained in what you eat. Think about this. The government has knowingly, willfully, and intentionally lied to every American for the better part of 60 years in order to put trillions of dollars into the pockets of big food, big med, and big pharma. And like other issues you may be able to think of, they refuse to perform honest research that would confirm the harm being done to hundreds of millions of American citizens. Billions of dollars a year in profits for various companies is the goal. Your sickness and misery isn't even a consideration for them. If you want to learn about the lies that have made America the most chronically ill society in history and how your physiology really works, go to drreality.news, drreality.news, and pick up a copy of Body Science. It is a roadmap for being incredibly healthy in a society filled with illness, misery, and premature death from having believed an utterly false narrative. I should also let you know that Body Science has never received anything less than 5 stars out of 5 in reader reviews. So do yourself a favor. Go to drreality.news and grab a copy of Income Tax Shattering the Myths or Body Science or both and have your mind blown by comparing the government's disinformation with the facts, the science, and the law, all laid out in crystal clarity for you. In doing so, you'll also help me to continue to be here for you with these fact-based presentations. And before I leave you, do please subscribe to the channel. Thanks for being here. Take care.
And this is the Alaska Patriot Network. This is Dahl, your host. We are here with Lori Ann, the host of the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann show. You can find that right here on Blog Talk Radio. We just listened to a clip from Dr. Reality, a.k.a. Dave Champion. And it was a great clip. And like I said, I'm not always in agreement with what he said, but he did have a lot of good points. And when I listened to this clip, I couldn't help but something kind of jumped out at me, and it was unexpected realization. And Lori Ann, I kind of cued you into what my thoughts on this were. But when you think of the lack of security and or purported lack of security and or the door being opened not by a third party but remotely by the Capitol Police, which is totally conceivable. I mean, home security systems are not just for, you know, the elite or the rich or, you know, public, you know, politicians or any of that. I mean, just about everybody has a Ring video or you know, Ring doorbell or some type of scenario like that. But what was really interesting was that when you look at what happened at the Pelosi household just last week, and then you look at January 6th, I know it's two completely different scenarios and stuff, but there is one person that is a constant there, and that's Nancy Pelosi. And she is in charge of that security for the Capitol Police. That, like, at January 6th, they couldn't call in the National Guard until Nancy Pelosi okayed it, and she didn't do it, and she didn't do it, and she didn't do it. Nancy Pelosi has briefings, like Dr. Reality said, you know, we all know they get security briefings. They know, you know, who's at risk, and especially if it, you know, includes their own household or family members or staff or offices or whatnot. And it just seems like Nancy Pelosi purposely allowed for the lack of security and lapse in, you know, public safety on January 6th on, you know, Capitol grounds. And it seems, too, that there was a huge, equally, you know, dangerous lack of security in her own home. And it just, it's I don't know what the agenda was with Paul Pelosi. I'm not buying it. I'm not going to go with the, I refuse to believe it was like some mega person and right-wing extremist, because the evidence that we have before us is glaringly opposite. But what is the constant there, though, is the lack of taking, you know, public threats seriously and securing the domain. And in both cases, by Nancy not securing the domain, her domain or public domain, put many lives at risk in one situation and one life or two lives at risk, or potentially even law enforcement at risk at her home location. So I think that that's something that we don't know why her, I know why she didn't want security, you know, at the Capitol. She wanted to escalate. So did she want something to escalate at home with her husband, Lorianne?
I wouldn't put it past her. You know, I'm getting more and more convinced that Pelosi is really good friends with Hillary Clinton, and Hillary advises her on complicit in situations and then deflect it and point fingers elsewhere. I think Pelosi's gotten that down. And I still feel the same way that I did. I would not put it past her, for whatever reason, to put a hit out on her own husband, because he's becoming a liability, causing a, you know, yes, with his DUI in that situation. I mean, there's too much work involved for her to continue to cover up for her husband. So, you know, that would explain a lot of things, you know, even though she wasn't at the residence at the time. It, you know, I can even access my own security cameras. I can access my own security system when I'm away from home via apps on my phone and stuff. You don't think Nancy can access it and turn things on or off? It'd be interesting to see what the security system's logs are on who and when security, you know, various security cameras or security, you know, triggers, you know, like for windows, for doors, motion detectors, things like that. be interesting to see, though, because that's also a thing. Like, I can go in, and I can, in my own security system, I can go in, and I can, every single thing that's happened in the log, when something was disarmed, when something was armed, when something was bypassed, all that stuff, and I can see, you know, who was logged in that did it, right? If it was me or if it was somebody else, you know, that kind of a thing, because I go to more than myself, you know, so it's one of those things, all that stuff. So it'd be very interesting to see if maybe, just maybe, Pelosi herself was in D.C., deliberately set this up. You never know.
Yeah, like she Jesse Smollett, her husband.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Or whatever.
Damn it,
name
he
is
survived
Justin
it.
Smollett.
He survived the hammer attack.
And
damn.
Yeah.
Her attempt failed.
Yeah. A guy wearing underwear attacked him with bleach and said, "This is mega country."
There you go. Definitely. I mean, you know, because, you know, they both have tested positive for COVID, so maybe they tried the inject yourself with bleach rumor.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but, you know, it just leaves still a lot to be, you know, it was the timing, the optics, everything about it. Regardless of what happened in that household with Paul and DePape, there's more to it than meets the eyes. She may have not been complacent, or maybe Paul did not, this wasn't a grinder drug thing gone wrong, but they seized the moment and they turned this into a victim dog whistle at the 11th hour when all they had to go to, you know, midterms with was abortion and Ukraine.
Yeah, that was it.
And Putin, boogeyman. You know, we have to kill babies to give women reproductive rights, but yet you're an asshole if you don't want to save Ukraine. I mean, that's all they had to do, had to go to the polls with. And now I'm not saying that I do not sympathize with people that are caught up in between this BS with Ukraine. But the rest of it, you know how I feel about it, Lorianne. Listeners know how I feel about it.
Yeah.
But so this is all they had to go to Election Day with. And it wasn't a lot. And that was their Hail Mary, was more victimhood and painting. Donald Trump did this. You know, Donald Trump had nothing to do with it. He hasn't been, you know, their president for a while. And yet they wanted to turn it on into like a cult following and turning into everybody into this boogeyman. And it worked. It seemed to have worked with them because between that and this election joke we've got going on in a few states, you know, counting ballots and whatnot, on top of the regular amount of expected fraud that happens in every election. Yeah, there's a lot
going into
this.
Which isn't that a sad thing to say? Isn't that a sad thing, this, the expected amount of fraud in every election? Like,
there is.
Like there's a normal amount of fraud and then there's abnormal. And it's only the abnormal. That and even the abnormal we're not allowed to question. We can question 2016, you know, that's okay. You know, 2016 with Trump's win, you can question that. Oh, that was a fraudulent election, blah, blah, blah. You know, you could question that one, but boy, oh boy, you can't question 2020 and you definitely can't question 2022.
Yeah, let's not forget that a sitting president of the United States was nearly impeached based on their idea of election fraud or what happened with the 2016 elections. A lot of people forget that that was the lead up to the impeachment. Russian collusion, Russian, Russia, 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 Russia.
Yep, yep. And people forget, and like, you know, and the left is like, oh, well, Trump met with Putin, you know, privately and blah, blah, blah. And no other president has ever done that. Well, guess what? You know, check your facts, man, because it's happened time and time again. Bush Jr. met with Putin privately. Obama met with Putin privately. Clinton, you name it. They've all, you know, this rhetoric of somehow what Trump did was different than anybody else is completely false. If you look up the history of it, plenty of leaders have had closed doors meetings with Putin. You know, it's just a fact.
Well, and not only that, though, not a lot of people are in the world like Trump is in the business world. He's a world player. He was a world player, accepting the, you know, running for presidency and accepting the responsibility of commander in chief was a huge downgrade in lifestyle for the guy. This is not elevating for him. In fact, that is the epitome of public service right there. And furthermore, he didn't get rich off it. He gave away his income from it. He can get rich off
exactly.
that, by the way.
That's another thing that a lot of people don't acknowledge.
Yeah, so Trump was already in the world. There was lots of world leaders that he had private audiences with and actual friendships with and or a business understanding. He knew the ways of the world, the real world. And that for people like the meat puppet, O'Biden, and Obama and, you know, the rest of them, that's an enviable position. He was already in the you know, popular guy circle. He didn't need to make any promises to any of them. They were already known to each other. But now we lost 4 years of a very good opportunity for this country to get back on its feet in so many ways. You know, it's infuriating because you look at, and here we go off and we've just segued off into something else, but you look at somebody like Donald Trump, he never promised you to make you feel good about anything. He never said he was going to not say things to hurt your feelings or to say that men were really women and or that women were really men. No, he just said, hey, I'm going to fix the economy. I'm going to fix your roads. I'm going to fix your bridges. We're going to get this country back and up where it can stand again and get it where it needs to be, you know, productive again. And you know, we've never been self-sustainable. We've always relied on, you know, import-export relationships, but not like we have now that we have been pushed into in the last 30 years. We are completely dependent on some really dubious characters for our most basic needs. And that was one of the things he wanted to move us away from. But we know his attributes, and we also know what some people believe his downfalls are. But, you know, I'd take mean tweets and safe streets any day.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, you know me. I'm a libertarian. I've had my issues with Trump, but I said it all along too. Like if I didn't vote for Joe Jorgensen, I would have voted for Trump over Biden any day. Because you know Biden, as many as you know, as the issues that I have with Trump are one thing, but with Biden, he is a disaster. We all knew he was going to be a disaster. And so if I had voted differently, not saying that I wish I had, but if I had voted differently, if my only choices were Biden or Trump, and nobody else, I would have definitely voted for Trump. Because, like you said, I mean, he's a businessman. He's already well-established in the world, already has relationships with a lot of power players in countries throughout the world because of his business relationships and things that, you know, he was very well-established in the business world internationally for a very long time. And I think that that's what this country needs. We need to start thinking of our government as being like a business. And you cannot run a company by continuously being in charge of your own credit limit. You know, this never-ending increase of our credit limit and printing of money and trillions of dollars in debt. You know, I mean, no company would be able to be $30 trillion in debt and still keep its doors open, you know. And I think that we need more leaders that that are business savvy, that do have already business relationships, because, you know, the fact of the matter is the separation between government and business, government and corporations, there is no separation anymore. And that is the reality that we're dealing with. And that's not just here in the United States, that's all across the globe. So that's a reality that we have to accept. And so in order to lead this nation and start separating the two, we need to unmarry them. We need to force a divorce between government and corporations. And in order to do that, we need business savvy people that can look at our government with the same kind of lens that they do in their businesses and start running a fiscally sound government. Because that's ultimately their job. You know, our government was not meant to continuously print money and continuously increase its credit limit and continuously the American taxpayer for generations to come into endless debt. This was something that our country was founded to prevent from happening. Because that's how civilizations fall. That's how England lost its power throughout the world. Why? Because they started doing these same things. They could no longer afford having all these empires all over the world. They were borrowing themselves and digging themselves deeper and deeper into debt, and therefore it was unsustainable. And, you know, before that was many other countries. You know, all throughout history, the same thing has happened with governments that overspend and overtax and overregulate and overcontrol and be too authoritarian. They always crumble. And so with the United States becoming more and more like that, we need more business savvy people to prevent, you know, to clog this, you know, to clog this up before it starts getting even worse, you know, and reeling things back and being actually fiscally responsible, not just fiscally conservative. That's needed, of course, but, you know, if you're not a conservative and you're a Democrat out there, at least demand that our government be fiscally responsible, you know. Instead of these blank open checks everywhere and throwing more money at stuff is never the answer. How many times do we keep throwing money toward education, supposedly, throwing money toward this, throwing money toward that? And does it really help? No, it doesn't. It just makes a bad situation worse.
Yep. Hey, well, Lorianne, we have a caller. Let's go ahead and bring this caller in and have him join the conversation before we get too far off track, because we don't know where they want to jump in from. So let's bring him in. You're on air. Welcome to the Alaska Patriot Network.
Well, y'all won the sweepstakes, so I figured I'd make y'all night tonight. How y'all doing?
Hey. I haven't heard you for a while. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm cooling. I'm cooling. You know how it goes. Nothing going on. It's Friday, slow Friday night, you know?
Yeah, and then, Dahl, I don't think you and Naj know each other. I don't think you've called into her show before. So, welcome on. What do you got to say
heard,
about the
yeah,
war?
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I heard your voice. So I was like, yeah, let me check out and see what they're talking about. Well, I mean, she knows I'm going to have a lot of problems with what you guys just said. So that's it's okay. We can still do this.
Hey, that's what it's about. I have no problem. Nobody has to agree with everybody.
Indeed. That's the way of the world, baby. So first thing.
Amen.
First, government can't be run like a business. Actually, if you run a government like a business, you'd be looking at a banana republic. That's essentially what happens when a banana republic has a dictator that takes over. You run a government like a business. A government, central services, and the idea of forever, because that's basically what you're doing when you're printing money. You're not printing money just because you want to run your economy badly. You're printing money because you have the credibility to do it. So if you're a sovereign nation, and you own your ability to print that money, the fact that you have taxpayers for generations after is why countries continue to invest in you. So it's not really a bad thing to be able to print money. Much worse thing is when people don't believe in you or your currency and won't invest in you. So if you're Venezuela, you can't sell government bonds. But if you're the U.S., you can, because people feel like they'll get a return on it. You guys get where I'm coming from?
No, completely. You're right on mark there. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, not exactly like a business, but being fiscally responsible, because if we're going to print money out of nowhere and we're going to create the inflation, because now there's more American dollars out there making inflation a thing, we have to be physically, responsible with it. We can't just keep spending frivolously. And like I said, it's like, yeah, government is different than business, but like I said, the marriage between the two is undeniable. And so in a sense, we can't keep running ourselves into the ground, because pretty soon, the more and more debt we get, soon enough, the American dollar is going to be less and less value, and there's going to be less and less countries investing in it, which we already see is happening. Other countries are starting to maneuver their way out of using the American dollar. Several countries are. Very key countries are. Saudi Arabia is one of them. I mean, so the more that happens, the less people are going to invest, and it's all going to backfire. And then America could literally become like Venezuela, where the U.S. dollar isn't worth jack anymore.
Yeah, so, okay, let's get into this. So here's the tough part. This is the hard part to deal with, because Lori knows I'm way far left. So, just for the audience, so they'll know they're listening to a person who's way far left. So the corporatocracy stuff, I agree with that already. I feel like corporations are already too big. Corporations, to me, in my opinion, they dictate the government more than anything else. We have a bigger corporate problem than we do government problem. But remember this. Whenever you're talking about national debt, we're talking about people's assets. So the one percenters in America, essentially, they are the ones who own the debt of the United States, because they – when you're looking for somewhere to park your money, a safe asset that when it's all finished and done, you're going to make a positive return on, you look for nations that will, give you that ability. So the 1% is in America, the most wealthy in America. There you go. Those are the owners of our national debt. Now, why do they keep investing in the United States? Because they know generation after generation, the United States has the best chance to still be standing as a country, which means they'll get a return on your investment. You want to invest in China? Well, guess what? You can't. They don't allow foreign money to come in into their stock market and invest in bonds or anything like that. They don't allow it. Other countries, less stable. You're looking at what, Germany, France, Sweden, Britain. Now, would you want to invest in Britain, seeing what's going on over there the last 2 years? So, you know, the United States is still safest one out there. People still getting a return on it. And remember, inflation was not caused by printing money. Inflation was caused by the pandemic situation where the supply chains broke down. And you guys kind of referred to this a couple of minutes ago where you talked about corporations looking for profits elsewhere. And some of our essential services, which is why when the pandemic started, we didn't have masks and all that stuff because they were being made in China. Everybody said, what the hell? Why is our stuff being made in China? Well, because corporations made more money by having it made by cheap labor. So the whole supply chain system has to change. And, you know, we're in the process of doing that. But globally, this is why inflation is hitting everybody. It's not because of printing money. It's because the whole system collapsed under the weight of the pandemic. And, you know, we're still feeling it. I think I paid $5 for this beer I'm holding right now. Ridiculous. But go ahead, y'all.
What kind of beer is it?
It's a Sapporo, one of those Japanese beers.
Oh, I love Sapporo.
Yeah, it felt a little festive.
So nice
today.
And clean.
But I never paid $5 for it.
Nice cold Sapporo.
I mean, you can't say that printing money doesn't do it. The level of printing money, you know, just flooding the market with all of this sudden money, that does decrease the value. There is a direct relationship there. We can't deny that. It's just like how if you, depending on the price of gold, right? When gold is scarce, maybe there's not as many mines, maybe, you know, supply chain issues, not as many people to work the mines to for gold, then it becomes more scarce. And then the price of gold goes up because there is less supply to meet the demand. But now all of a sudden, if there's a new gold mine, you know, gold is discovered in a new location, and that location has cheap labor in order to mine it and stuff. Now all of a sudden, gold is aplenty. And when gold is aplenty, then the price is going to go down. And so money is no different. Just printing money out of nowhere and flooding the market with all of these new dollars inevitably decreases the value of that dollar. There is definitely a direct relationship.
Well, I'll give you the best test case scenario, and I don't know what you want to do with this, but this is going to be a tough one. So in 2010, we had a worldwide recession. This was under Obama. Worldwide recession. Every country on earth was in trouble economically. And what did we do? The countries who had good standing and were looked at as safe places, those countries printed money. They used government money to kind of, I guess you could say, kind of lean into the recession as it was going. So then you could kind of ease off it as your businesses and everybody started to kind of recuperate. You could back off it. So 2010, you had, I guess you could say, 12 of the wealthiest countries in the world printing money wholesale at the same time, and it did not cause global inflation. So, I mean, like, check out Mark Blyce. His work on this is really good. He's an economist out of Brown. It's just hard to create a direct correlation between printing money and inflation. But when we get to the supply chain stuff, like, it's obvious. It's right there. Like, me and you talked about it. There was a situation in Canada where, because it's a little warmer in Canada, they had a mild winter, there was a beetle that stayed alive longer than it normally does, and it ate into the lumber. That caused the lumber to be less available, which rose, you know, lumber and housing prices and construction and everything else in the U.S. for 2 years after that. Like, that one little beetle caused all those problems. But, yeah, it's hard to find a direct correlation between printing money and that. Now, if you're a country who doesn't have any assets that anybody wants or nobody likes, So say Zimbabwe in 2000, when they started printing money and their currency shot up to the point of where people had to take a wheelbarrow to the grocery store. Yeah, that's a different scenario. Or if you take, you know, Germany, when they were paying off paying off the penalty to France, and basically France was bleeding them dry, inflation shot up, and Germany decided, well, to hell with it. If you're just going to rob us like this, then we'll just print all of the money and tank our currency. And people were upset, and that's how you get the rise of Hitler in Germany, because, you know, the economic situation was so hard, and France wanted to punish them for every piece of that Versailles Treaty, and, you know, there was just nothing to be done. So most of the time when you see inflation caused by printing money, it was done by that country on purpose. I just gave you the two examples, Germany, of course, and, of course, Zimbabwe. But, like, modern efficient economies, it's just hard to find any record of it. And if you guys want, I'll give you a good book on it. It's called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Check that book out. It kind of gets into it.
I definitely will.
Rough, man. Yeah.
I'm going to let Dahl speak first.
Here, take a drink of that beer.
You know,
it's Friday
you know.
Night, Naj.
See, this is why I like Naj, though. I mean, he is liberal, and you know, but he is having conversations with him, even just disagreeing with opinions, is actually very. It gets you thinking, and just the fact that we can do so peacefully and not be all crappy to each other. I'm
right,
watching
right,
my
but,
language.
We're adults here.
Yeah, like. But this
but
is
remember,
okay.
I'm worse than a liberal, though. I'm a leftist. I've never voted for the Democratic Party. I voted for the Greens and any, you know, way left socialist worker party or whatever. You know, Bernie Sanders, anybody you want to know, I voted for them instead of Dems. Remember, I'm way worse than a liberal. I don't get along with them at all.
How many times do you hear a liberal say that they're way worse than your normal liberal?
I know. What the hell?
I love it.
Yeah, I'm a leftist, man.
You know, but I mean,
those,
seriously,
but.
I want to hear other people's thoughts and stuff. And like even with, you know, the first clip we played, I love Dave Champion. He's a friend. We've had him on shows. Don't always agree with everything, and right off the bat, he's referring to my idea of his, you know, the Pelosi thing as being a child in an adult's body, you know, type thing. But, hey, you know, I'm good with that. And I love to hear other people's takes on things. You know, just because you have some type of, political, idealism or identity or whatever, you know, and stuff doesn't mean you still can't learn from others. And it's through that knowledge. If you just close your mind off and you're like, la, 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 don't want to hear it, You're just as bad as the opposition. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous
Let me give you guys an example. An example is right now we're seeing in the Republican Party a push to move out Mitch McConnell. Every leftist I know texted me. Everybody was laughing, smiling, and hoping that it happens. You know why? Because I hate Mitch McConnell's guts. I think he's a terrible person, but he's one of the most effective political maneuvers we've seen over the past century. Like, there's going to be books written about some of the things he's done politically and was able to get away with. The fact that he denied Obama a Supreme Court seat. The fact that he was able to rally the base in a way to get the votes in lockstep to deny them at every point. Like, those are things that are going to be taught in political science classes. Like, Mitch McConnell is really good at what he does. So, like, the Republican infighting, if they push Mitch McConnell out, I'm telling you right now, every leftist I know is going to be celebrating because we want that dude out of there, man. You can't beat him in an election because he has Kentucky locked the hell up. And if you guys remove him, man, people are going to celebrate, man, because he is a terrible Darth Vader-like figure. But he is good at his job, I'm telling you, man.
He is good at his job, but it's like, what kind of good is it? Is it the good for all? Is it the good for some? Or
well,
is it just
good
the good for him?
Well, yeah, you know.
For him
for
and
donors,
his health. And he's part of the bigger problem. And sadly, too, and there will be more joy on the leftist side. I hate to say it, but, you know, this Trump and DeSantis thing has the party imploding upon itself, the rhino conservative scenario. And sadly, the left doesn't have to do anything. The right's doing it all on their own. We're imploding upon ourselves, and you're seeing it just in a windfall. It's like the gift that keeps on giving, and nobody had to do anything. It was like somebody blew on the house of cards.
Yeah, yeah, but
you know, and the Libertarian Party's the same way too. It's like, you know, the Republicans and the Libertarians that tend to be more conservative leaning. Both of them are imploding in and on themselves at the same time.
They'll eat their own.
Well,
yeah, they're going to eat their own if it's not.
They're embarrassed because they blew a once in a lifetime opportunity. Midterm elections, typically the people who are in typically get shellacked at midterms, and with the economy the way it is, dealing with inflation, dealing with everything else. It should have been a slam dunk victory for a red wave. It didn't happen, so now they got to figure out something. But I don't think the Trump DeSantis thing is going to go far. I think the main donors in the Republican Party are going to tell DeSantis, you got to wait your turn. We're putting our money behind Trump, and at that point, he really won't have a choice. So I don't think that's going to go far. I think they're going to tell him to chill. That'll be interesting though if he bucks against it. But where is he going to get the money? Because say what you want to say. To win American election in 2022 or 20 or beyond, look, money is more important than anything in winning a national election at that level. Like, you've got to have the money. And if the money is still behind Trump, DeSantis has to stand down.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What do you see happening with Bernie? Do you think he'll run again in 2024? Come on, we've entertained you. Now you entertain us.
No, it doesn't matter. The donors in the Democratic Party, excuse me for that Freudian slip, y'all can do with that
That's
what you
right.
will. But the donors
nah,
in the Democratic Party not only don't want Bernie, they don't want anything like Bernie. So the DNC is not going to allow Bernie or any other progressive to gain any power. They're going to continue to run centrist and old fogies like your boy Joe, because Joe will play his role. He'll attack progressives and limit anything that could be done that would actually improve people's lives, and he'll govern as a centrist and spend the majority of his time saying, well, the Republicans are going to eat you. At least I won't do that.
Yeah, well, old Joe will do anything for a sniff here and there and a double dip cone.
So, I mean, that's essentially his job. That's his job. So all of the progressive things that actually poll well on the left and the right, when people start talking about health care, access to insulin, the idea of infrastructure spending, the things that matter to real people in America – those things don't matter to the donors. The donors want status quo, and as long as they can get a Hillary or a Joe as the Dem nominee, then they can keep those things right where they are. Like you saw a couple weeks ago, the so-called squad, AOC and company, they came out with I would say a light critique of the idea of the Ukraine-Russia war, where they said, you know, there needs to be negotiations for peace. We need to figure out a way out of this. And the hard right of the Democratic Party came down on them immediately, and they denounced the letter and took it back and got back in line. So there's really no progressive wing within the Democratic Party. It's just a center-right centrist party. So this is what we have. There's old Joe.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, I mean, I'm going to have to agree, Naj. I'm like I said, just because somebody is a dissident or not, you know, I mean, doesn't mean I can't agree or find some common ground. And I think we all need to find a little more common ground, because this is our home. All of us have to live here. We have to coexist here somehow, some way, you know. And if it's a little give and take or a little bit of meeting in the middle, we need to do it. People have done it before us. We can do it now. And it's not even about the party. It's about the kids.
I don't know if we can do it now. The ability to, like, put an echo chamber around a group of people has never been more powerful than it is now. So I don't know how to figure out a way to meet in the middle, because if I get my information from one source,
being a centrist is almost unheard of anymore. You have to be extreme right or extreme left and no in between. And, you know, otherwise you're going to be ridiculed and shunned and you know, stalked or whatever. And that's the sad part about it, is like, you know, we could take just about any issue and nobody from the extremes is going to be happy with any kind of solution presented by people that are moderate or centrist, you know, and that's the problem right now. Republicans are seeing it. If they aren't extreme right, then their own party will attack them and ensure that they don't advance. And same thing with the Democrats. If they're not extreme left, then people within their own party will make sure that they don't win their elections as much as possible. There's a lot of corrupt stuff going on both sides.
Well, it's a little different, though, because the energy is on the extreme right in the Republican Party, so they kind of have to kowtow to those people in a way that they didn't have to in the past. On the left, the extreme left actually doesn't have a voice within the DNC. Matter of fact, the DNC wished those people didn't exist. They don't want anything to do with them. Go back to the Obama administration when all of these progressive candidates ran in different areas. Man, Rahm Emanuel would get in his damn old Buick and drive to try to get a centrist candidate elected over the progressive candidate, because they didn't want any part of anything the progressives were bringing to the table, which is why, you know, they did to Bernie and everything else. That, like, the DNC and progressives cannot exist in the same place, because ultimately the donors of the Democratic Party, big media people, entertainment, big tech, those people who write the big checks, they don't want anything to do with these people talking about free college and universal health care and all other things that the progressive left talks about. So the progressives and the Dems, they have no say. But the problem is, when you're wearing a centrist Dem, typically people look at it and say, well, hell, if I'm going to vote for a conservative light, I might as well just vote for a conservative. So, like the election in Ohio this time, what was his name? Tim Ryan, I think his name was, where he lost to the old book writer. If you're going to run as a
J.D. Vance.
Why the hell? Yeah, that's why J.D. Vance beat him. It's like, if you're going to run as a conservative light, why the hell wouldn't they just vote for the conservative?
Yeah. I don't know. Tell you, this election's been such a blindside. I mean, like, I've been so blindsided by this whole election. Rhyme or reason.
Here in Oregon, I mean, literally, I am still in disbelief about Oregon passing very narrowly Measure 114. I'm like, you're like, literally, voters in Oregon, you're that stupid? Really? I mean, 50.9% with 86% of ballots, expected ballots reporting. And I say expected because they're still counting ballots already received, right? And so long as, and as of 2020, so this is the first year where It only has to be postmarked. If you mailed it in, it has to be postmarked by Election Day on Tuesday. But it can still take another couple of days to actually get received, do the signature verification, and then actually get counted. So we have no idea how many more ballots are actually out there. So this 86% reporting, I got a question, where are they getting that from? You know, is that just 86 of the total ballots received so far? But there's still more on the way. And anyway, so 50.9%.
Yeah, but those are from Republican-leaning counties, though. So
pass the most, unconstitutional gun measure ever. Measure 114, I don't know if you're familiar with it. I've talked a lot about it.
No, I'm not. Let me know.
Oh, it's going to be the most strict gun control law in the United States, and it's passing by only 0.9% so far. And they've declared it passed, even though there's still more ballots to count. It's so close.
Does 0.9% trigger a runoff there for that? Or
no.
Is 0.9 is
no.
enough? As
It'll
long as they
pass.
Get over, they get over.
They've declared it passed already. And that's the thing. It's like, how do you
know?
There's still ballots coming in, you know. But, yeah, this it requires a permit to purchase a firearm. So you have to pay up to $65, get a background check, get fingerprinted. You have to take a gun safety course, including, I believe it's something like, actual at the range target, all of that in order to get this permit to purchase it. And it also requires the state police to develop and maintain a database for all of these permits, because they're going to last 5 years. So once you get through all those hurdles, it's supposed to last 5 years. And they're supposed to create this database, and this database doesn't exist. So meanwhile, now, I'm going to put something in perspective for you. When it comes to Oregon creating a new, you know, database or online system that can be checked and accessed by all the law enforcement agencies, they haven't figured this out yet. And so to get this permit to purchase a new firearm, we need this database, the database that doesn't exist. And when you look at Oregon, back in 2010, Oregon was given an allotment of $80 million by the federal government to update its unemployment department system because their servers are running on software from the mid-90s, even to this day. They never did it. And in 2020, they said, oh, yeah, we're going to start doing it. You know, we're going to get this done. And there hasn't been anything even since. So still, they had $80 million to do this. They sat on it for over a decade. Now they've estimated it's going to cost like $140 million in order to update it. So now they need to get more money because they sat on that $80 million when they could have done it. Now, do you expect how long do you expect, given just that track record alone, don't even get me started on the Oregon Health Plan website. That was a fiasco and took forever. And so now our state's police are supposed to develop a secure, searchable database and be responsible for maintaining it, testing it, deciding what information is going to be included, all of that.
It hasn't been developed.
And so this is going to stall anybody that wants to purchase a new firearm. Great, sure. They can't be issued a permit because this database doesn't exist, and it's going to take God knows how long before it does.
So when the database is up and running, did they say where the money from the fees for it goes? Where does that go?
question. The $65 fee is supposed to pay for your expanded background check and fingerprinting. So basically, you're treated like a criminal in order to get this permit in order to purchase a firearm. But then not only that, and not only with this database, then it also limits magazine capacity to 10 rounds, which immediately makes the firearm I own illegal. I can possess it in my own home. However, the writing of this legislation is very vague when it comes to, okay, well, what if I actually have to use it? You know, it makes exceptions for transporting it, like if you're going to a gun buyback program or you're going to get it repaired or you're going to, you know, go in so that you can register for this or whatever. I mean, they make certain exceptions. So basically, if you want to turn your gun in, then it's not illegal to transport it. But outside of that, you know, my gun is going to be illegal for me to carry or bring with me or use anywhere outside of my own home. Then it also undermines our current concealed carry requirements, because the concealed carry license doesn't have the same requirements as this permit in order to purchase a firearm to begin with. So there's all these, you know, it's intermingling with an overriding somehow, like it's a bunch of confusion. The Union for Oregon Sheriffs have been against passing Measure 114. And there are already two county sheriffs that have put out that they are not going to enforce the magazine capacity portion of it, and neither are they going to enforce the rest of it until they know how to set up this damn database, you know, and what information to include and come up with the rules on what information they're going to ask of people in order to apply for the permit and blah, 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 blah. And here's the kicker. So even you, so you get the permit that you pay that $65 and it includes the background check. It includes all this other stuff, right? So let's say, and then the database is done. And so you finally get your permit. You've been delayed getting purchased a firearm, being able to purchase a firearm for how many months? Is that not an infringement? Just that unreasonable delay? That's an infringement right there. I cannot see this passing in the courts at all. But not only that, then when you actually get your permit, yay, I've been approved for my permit. And then you go to the gun store and you pick out the gun you want. Then guess what? You got to pay another background check. And then you got to wait for that background check to pass through. And that can take up to 30 days.
Well, I think, so Lori, and I'm not,
you know,
I'm not a Oregon resident, but I believe that, like, ballot measure 114 is a egregious overreach. It's the gateway to gun control, and they're testing it out in Oregon. And this measure, just like it's like the gateway. Any type of Oregon legislative gun control can come of this ballot measure. And also, the problem I have with this measure in itself, and well, one of the many problems I have it with, is that it would require government permission to exercise your Second Amendment constitutional rights. And right there, I can see that passage, that right there being enough for a judicial over, this being overturned judicially.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility, but the danger of it is, as Lori kind of laid out, you think about the revenue raising there. So you take that money, you tie it to something that becomes very hard to be against, meaning, let's say, well, 15% of this goes to orphanages in Oregon. So when the people come and say, well, we're against this, we don't like this measure, and they say, well, this money is actually paying for the orphanages and da, da, da. Are you against kids? Are you against orphans? And then it turns into that argument. And before you know it, they're justifying everything with the amount of revenue that they raise. this is going to bring in X amount of dollars for taxpayers, and therefore, if you're against it, you're actually against the state being, you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah.
Well, here's another part of it, too.
Here, I'm going to bring up something real quick, Lorian, is that, you know, in the writing of ballot measure 114, when these permits and these classroom times and all of this stuff is not state-run. It is to be done in a live-firing training. Yeah, live-fire training offered only by law enforcement certified instructors. There is no limit to the amount that can be charged for these classes. Facility and ranges for classes are extremely limited. I want to know who's getting the contract for these.
Exactly.
Who's getting...
So this is grifting.
And you know what? You were right on the ball with what I was about to say, because during the pandemic, there were a lot of shooting ranges that closed down because of all the social distancing and stuff. You know, people weren't going there, you know.
Yeah.
Things were closed down. So a lot of them closed the doors. We literally do not have enough shooting ranges out there to accommodate every single person that wants to purchase a firearm that now needs to meet this requirement of going to a shooting range and getting so many hours of practice time and showing their, you know, ability to fire their weapon, right? So this requirement right there is another situation where shooting ranges do not have that capacity. They just don't. We don't have enough of them anymore, and they don't have the capacity to accommodate all those people.
If you want to do the social and economic equity card here, this is the perfect time to pull it, Naj, because I'll tell you, I grew up in poverty, extreme poverty, and there is no way that my family would have been able, anybody in my family would have been able to come up with the extra income to do something like this. This would have been something like we would have saved up for just to go hunting, to feed our families.
When this happens, to follow the chain of events. So bill passes, everything goes through. You start looking at the companies and say, okay, wait a minute. Is this person related to this person, or is there a relationship here? Has this person made a donation to the governor, a state senator, a local congressman? Like, you're going to look into
all that. It's like I'm always watching Soros. Everything links back to Soros, you know? No, seriously.
Y'all got to leave Soros alone, man. Y'all, look.
Billions invested over decades.
Hold on one second.
Hold on
before y'all do that. I'm going to give y'all the true Soros story so y'all know how this actually works. In the 90s, this is how George Soros got famous. In the 90s, George Soros famously shorted the British pound. He shorted them to the extent that they ended up having to pay him to sell his shares in order to get rid of him, because he would have destroyed their currency by taking such a large position. That's how he made the majority of his wealth. He comes back to the United States. He starts up a foundation, Open Society. Any activist group out there, you go to opensociety.com, you apply, and maybe you get the grant, maybe you don't. It's, you know, it's like any other grant out there, and you get the money. Now, he became like kind of famous on circles on the right because of some of the organizations that were connected to him that were able to get some of the money. But remember, again, this dude is a currency manipulator. He's not like this nefarious guy in a smoky room that people have kind of made him out to be. He's just a stock trader and a currency manipulator who got lucky that he was right the one time he was right in a really big way. So he basically blackmailed Britain into paying him a lot of money because of the position he took and some of the things that they were doing at the time. And you guys talked about this earlier, where you talked about the decline of the British Empire, early 90s, By the time we get to David Cameron, England is kind of the shadow of itself, and everything makes sense. They join the EU, but they keep the British pound, but they've never been a, you know, a great power like they were before. They're a junior partner to America.
No, they went to universal income and shut down all their industries.
Well, they didn't really have many industries. You got to remember, the majority of their wealth is derived from colonialism way back in the day when they had the greatest But when it came to the real world stuff, like they import 2/3 of their food. It's a small island. Like, it's not this great destination. They're a banking colony, essentially, now. And, you know, they're our junior partner, and they kind of got to accept that now. But, yeah. The sun will never shine on that empire in the way that it did way back in the day, man. That can never happen again.
No.
But George Soros is not as evil as people think he is, but he is a currency manipulator. That's the main charge people need to hold against him, because that's what he did. He basically held those people's economy, you know, like a hostage. Like, that's the thing he needs to really be accused of. Now, if you want to say that's non-ethical, which I would, like, that's some terrible stuff to do to anybody, but that's the main thing that he did.
All right. Well, I agree to disagree and beg to disagree, but, you know, I don't know if you know who Pianki is. We're going to bring Pianki in.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Pianki?
Yeah, I was
Pianki loves me so much, man. I'm his favorite person on this show.
I
was just listening and recording and to make sure this old man don't say anything out of the room. And make sure that when he's sitting there at the table, make sure he keeps his hands on top of the table in front of him. Don't let him put his hands beneath the table. He found in the past,
I love
that's
you,
the best
Pianki.
Way to deal with him. But other than that, you know, you talk about Oregon, and I don't understand Oregon either. Looking at your population, Laurie, is you got less than 4 million people, and 82% of the population is white, and about less than 1.5% is black. So you shouldn't have too much crime. I know. Yeah, I know. I'm saying it like that, but I'm not. Well, you know what I'm talking about. But I don't know why come they would have such strict gun regulations restrictions like they have anyway. I thought Illinois was the worst.
No, because they got all those silly white people over there making all those choices. No, seriously, they are rolling this out. They are rolling this out. They're rolling this out in Oregon because they're trying it for other places. And, I mean, literally, these poor people in Oregon are going to be paying for their constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why.
Yeah.
They what the heck? I thought that people there thought they were really smart. No offense, Lori, and you're really smart, but the rest of them, the other 99.9%, we are not very smart right now.
So far, 50.9% of the population of Oregon are complete freaking idiots as it stands right now. I am not a part of that 50.9%.
Lori Ann, in their defense, these people were scared from the events from 2020 where you had the situation with the so-called free area, and people have used that to, I don't want to say win, you know, political races, but they've been able to use that fear to scare people into a way that, you know, you can get stuff done when people are scared. Go back to the Patriot Act 2001 after the terrorist attack. Like, these things happen.
That rolled it out. That was the most dangerous act that America ever accepted blindly, out of fear. People do crazy stuff out of fear. We've seen it from 9/11 up through now.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, y'all can't blame this on us. There ain't too many of us out there except Dame Lillard. Like, once you get outside of Portland, I mean, you ain't going to see too many black folks. Like, go to Medford, Oregon.
I don't blame it on black folks.
Yeah, exactly. There is really not a very big population of people of the black color in southern Oregon or even eastern Oregon.
But this has nothing to do with race. This has nothing to do with race.
You got more blacks in the NFL than what's in Oregon.
I mean, it shouldn't, but, you know, what are those reasons? What's the reason behind that is the question. You know, why aren't black people in Oregon, you know, spread out across the state and in all these various cities instead of just concentrated in the Portland area?
Yeah, you guys have a history out there, so people aren't really trying to get
No.
But,
Oregon has a racist history? No.
Who erased the history against Moose?
There ain't no moose in Oregon.
Okay. You know, I was looking at the COS, the Convention of States map, in Montana, Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Nevada, and California have no activities been going on out there at all, nor Minnesota. So most of your activity for the Convention of States is in your southern states, Utah, Arizona, and North Dakota, Nebraska. Different minds out that way. You know, they always say that the United States consists of about 11 countries. And, you know, you got your southern.
That.
Yeah, you got your Yankeedom. You got your D-South, and out there where Oregon is, I think they call it the Washingtonians or the Oregonians or something like that. So they got a different mindset up that way.
Oh, hey, here's an interesting bit of news that I saw yesterday is two counties in eastern Oregon, another two counties have voted to join Idaho. So, you know, this is another thing that isn't really talked about. Like, seriously, there are counties in eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, and even northeastern California that are pushing to become like a greater Idaho. And with more and more of these counties signing on to it, it's like, it's one of those things, it could happen. And you know, we want to try to laugh about it, but it actually really could happen. And when you look at the map, you know, look at our electoral map from the last 20 years, and you will see that, you know, dominantly eastern and southern Oregon are conservative, and it's only Portland and Salem, Eugene, and like Seaside on the coast. And Bend that are blue. It's like, you know, it's just, and they're getting fed up. So it's like, you can't like not understand why they would want to push for this because they don't feel that they're being truly represented, especially when it comes to gun rights. I mean, you think all these Eastern Oregonians are going to be like, you know, I'm a law-abiding citizen and everything, but this is BS and I'm not going to comply with it. I mean, you know, you can just see. You know,
this plays into Pianchi's point where he says it's basically a nation of 11 countries, which I think is a really astute observation. America's never been the great melting pot or any of these other things where we try to describe ourselves in a way to where there's a common nation to it that has never existed. We are a regional, fractured people, and that's kind of the way that it's always been. So, those people's wives need to tell them to come home. You're not going to be able to join Idaho, which is another less populated, mostly land state. Like you got to stay in Oregon and go make your arguments to the other Oregonians. Like you don't get to just opt out. It's like down here in Georgia, we see this a lot, where a local suburb will all of a sudden apply for to become a city. They'll say, oh, well, we should be a city because we're nothing like Atlanta. We're a little different. And it's like they don't have any of the infrastructure to be a city. They don't have any of the income to be a city. Anything that would qualify them as a city besides the fact that they want to figure out a way to separate themselves from, you know, Atlanta. And,
traditionally, it doesn't take much to be a city. You know, back in the frontier days, all it took to be a city was, do you have a bar?
Do you have a blacksmith? A bar.
You need a blacksmith.
Some place to work. Yep, that was it.
Yeah, and a wood shop, you know, some place for lumber. You got to have lumber in order to build and whatever. So some very fundamental things made up a city. Very few. And maybe a bank, if you're lucky enough. So a bank,
a bar,
a brothel,
is, would
a blacksmith.
You want to live in that city? For the most part, most people, no. You want to live in a city with stuff, infrastructure, you know?
Oh, by the way, Nodge, how you been doing, buddy?
I'm good, man. What's going on?
How's the family? Everybody all right? That's good.
Yes, sir. How about you, man? I know you saw Dustin Baker in the World Series, so you should be still celebrating, Pianki.
Yeah, wasn't that good for Dusty Baker, man? I tell you the truth. I don't agree with their statement on America blacks not being in baseball. It's because kids direct themselves toward basketball and football. So anyway, I'm happy for him. I really am. He's been around for a long time.
Yeah, Dusty's almost like Forrest Gump, man. This dude smoked a joint with Jimi Hendrix. This dude was Willie Mays, you know what I'm saying, guy as a youngster. You know what I mean? Like, he's lived a charmed life. Yeah, I was happy about that too, man. But if y'all don't know, looks like Carrie Lake is going to lose in Arizona, and she is on Twitter going nuts so right now. This is not a
– well,
well, that's because there's still like 400,000 votes to count just in that county.
There's no way that Hobbs won this. Unless this is the season of winning for people that have no charisma, no agenda, no nothing, and also you're, you know, Secretary of State and part of elections.
refused to recuse herself. It's like, if that's not a blatant conflict of interest, so she's in charge of her own, you know, she's playing Secretary of State in charge of this election. When it's in her own self-interest.
you're preaching to the choir.
What's their run for governor?
We said this last time. That, Kemp in Georgia. It happened down here, so I'm not surprised.
That kind of that type of process is totally ridiculous, taking days after the election to tally the vote. That's why I come federal ballots should be separate from state and local. There's no way you can control it. But you can't control the federal ballot. Congress should do that.
You can have it both ways. You can't not invest in politics as far as the infrastructure for the county and the whole election process and then complain about it on the other end. So, you know, in Arizona, Sinema, it took her 2 days to be elected last time. Now, all the Dems are still mad at her because she's more of a moderate and she's more a conservative than she is anything else. They're still mad at her. But it took her 2 days to win her election in Arizona because they won't spend the money on the election cycle, which is crazy because you end up looking like the backward state who can't get it right.
Well, the federal government gives them money when it's done the way it is now, but if there's no transparency, look at Pennsylvania. They're saying that it's going to take a week to get all their ballots counted. It don't make any sense. Heck, things was faster back in the day before they even had fax machines.
Yeah, they shouldn't have run odds, though, man. In Pennsylvania, they are really big.
Yeah,
no,
there, I
like
agree.
Like a Pennsylvanian.
They should not have run.
And Fetterman
Come on,
played
give
into
us
that Pennsylvania football guy stuff. I'm being real.
No,
like,
no,
I'm not
no,
a backer
I'm
of
serious.
Fetterman. Fetterman leaned
no,
into
no,
that
no,
football
no,
guy,
serious.
Pennsylvania dude stuff. And Oz lost, basically, because they painted him as an outsider.
Was an outsider. I'm sorry, but even, you know, with conservative candidates, you don't want to – the party doesn't need to bring somebody to the table that people do not even relate to. Oz is completely unrelatable to the Pennsylvania constituency. I'm sorry, there's nothing about polished Oz that is desirable, that is relatable, that gives that, hey, this guy knows where I've been. This person understands, yeah, I might be immigrant, blah, blah, his parents, blah, 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 blah. But I have to say, he was the worst. I mean, I can't help but feel like there was some kind of nefarious thing going on there. I mean, I never liked Oz for a candidate. And
I agree. Like, yeah, he's been a snake oil salesman his whole freaking life.
Yeah.
Why would that
what
be any different now?
He's always right. Been with Oprah. Why the fuck? Oh, excuse me. Why the heck would I even entertain? I didn't even watch him on TV. I don't even watch TV, but still, I feel like that was like a gift from I don't even know what. And then Trump endorsed him to boot. I mean, that was like a double blow for the Conservative Party because a lot of people put that clout that goes with it. But, you know, Trump wasn't appointing these people or anything. He was just being a spokesperson and a cheerleader or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, no, Oz was the worst choice for Pennsylvania. I feel like he was planted there so that Fetterman would win.
He spent some money. So essentially, like, and this is one downside of Trumpism where, you know, Trump is who he is. But if somebody comes to him and they're going to donate to his campaign, they're going to donate to his fund, then, you know, he'll do a favor for him. But, you know, he's a guy, regular guy.
You know,
getting
back to Oregon, the average earnings in Oregon is $40,789 a year. My goodness, how did you guys survive with that?
What's
out
the
there, Notch. This is me directing to you, and these other young ladies are listening. Black population in Oregon is less than 75,000, but blacks are double the state poverty rate. They're at about 28%. Now I'm gonna ask you a question: what in the world?
I'm pretty damn sure
on?
Our Oregon government wants it that way.
Yeah. Well, hang on for a second. Now, see, this goes against all these other arguments I hear. This state is not in the South. There were no slaves there. Okay.
Yeah.
And you got less than 75,000. Hang on for a second.
Oh, but don't forget, Oregon set up intern camps for Japanese U.S. citizens. And put them
and
in there
paid,
treated them like crap.
Well, but they had to because
as
of that particular type of war.
They didn't have to.
Well, yes, you do. When you have that many people behind your lines and you fight in a nation like Japan, at that time, they had to do that.
Not when you have, like, you know, second, third generation. I mean, it didn't matter. If you even look like an Asian, you could be from Thailand, didn't matter. If you even looked Asian, you know, it was
Lori,
Nazism.
Believe me, Lori, blood is thick in the water. How many generations do you have? How many generations do you have of blacks in this country? And they talk down against the United States all the time. But I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just asking.
He messed up.
Well, come on, man. Can I just say what I got to say? Why is it that you progressives
I'm sorry,
and
man.
Liberals
calm
don't
down.
Want us conservatives to talk?
Oh, no. Here we go.
I'm sorry, man. Relax. Calm down, man.
I'm just asking a question. Here you got blacks in Oregon less than 75,000, and they are down near 28% in under the poverty rate, and then the average wage in Oregon is about $40,789. Hell, man, you can get that amount of money playing pinochle on the weekend.
You can barely afford rent at that. Seriously, if you want to get even a modest one-bedroom apartment in Portland, you're looking at $1,300 a month. here in Salem, you're looking at maybe $1,100 a month for just a decent one bedroom, like not roach infested, you know, kind of thing. I mean, you can't make it on $40,000 a year, not even that. And then, you know, I know abortion is touchy, but guess what? The abortion clinics are set up in the very neighborhoods that people of color are prominent in. What little of the population there is of black people here in Oregon tend to be concentrated in certain areas, and that's exactly where the abortion clinics are. I can attest to that, because I looked, like, where in Portland are the when I lived in Portland, where are the abortion clinics? All of them were in predominantly black areas.
How are they doing so bad? Even in education, they got the least in high school graduates. They got the least in, with bachelors. They about even with the, they're not doing too bad with bachelors, but high school graduation rate is the least of anybody. So my question is this. It's just a simple question. How is it that they do so bad even in states like Oregon, where they only make up less than 1.5% of the population? My goodness, what's going on?
Well, I guess I would ask you a simple question. Do you think, and this is a universal question for everybody, if you do want to chime in, do you think Homo sapiens sapiens are the same thing?
What do you mean?
Homo sapiens?
That's the scientific term for what we all are. Is
what do you mean do I think they are all the same?
But what's the double reference, Homo sapiens sapiens? What does that signify by?
Homo sapien is one of our
sapiens. Sapiens is the species that we are.
So that's one of our direct sapiens.
They're the species that we are today is sapiens. Stop.
Right.
What's your question?
So my point in saying that is simple. I think all humans are the same. I think all humans are what they are. And if conditions are what they are, then you're going to get certain outcomes. So anywhere in America where black people exist, yes, they are going to be lower on the totem pole than other people in that area. It's not a surprise to me. Do you think that's a failing of black people? No, I think that's the structure of the United States. Now, when you do look at a similar group and you say, okay, well, let's look at poor white people. Let's look at poor white people in Oregon. Let's look at poor white people in Appalachia. Why are they generationally similarly behind? Well, because if you're starting out and you're running a race, but you have to jump over 20 hurdles, but everybody else has to jump over 10 or 5, things will be a little more difficult and you'll get the outcome that you get. But I don't think that's a failing of any people because what? We're all Homo sapiens sapiens.
Well, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? There's some Africans that come here and ones that's born second, third, fourth, fifth generation, they outdo everybody. They are Homo sapiens sapiens, aren't they? Last time I checked, I ain't pulled up no dresses, pulled down any pants, but
So it's
something going on in the culture, and you would expect, I don't think the blacks in Oregon have the same culture as those in the Midwest, Illinois, and so forth. Matter of fact, I know they don't. And the ones down here,
I can attest a little bit to that because, I'm sorry, but, you know, this was a few years ago, but I'm going to tell you a story, okay? Story time, lucid libertarian style. But
is this appropriate for
Fred Meyer.
Patriot Network?
Yes, it is. And I'm just going to say, it's like, you know, me being a white woman, I had just gotten into my Fred Meyer grocery store, my shopping cart, gathered that, and this really hot, tall, good-looking black guy and his friend, who is also good-looking, but, you know, a little shorter than me, not quite as good-looking. I'm checking him out, you know, and, of course, the tall, black guy, good-looking guy, I'm like, I'm sitting there with my cart, and I'm, like, looking at him, and I'm having, you know, some good thoughts. I'm like, damn, he's fine, you know.
Marianne.
And, you know, sorry, but, you know, hey. And so this guy sees me looking at him and stuff, and he gets all defensive. He literally says to me, "What the fuck you looking at, white bitch?" And I'm like,
Lorianne. Lorianne.
You know, like literally that's what he
Lorianne.
Said. That's what he said. And I'm like,
I know, but.
But, and my response to him was, I'm like, you know, I was checking out a really fine-looking tall black man. Too bad he turned out to be an asshole. And his friend next to him literally fell on his knees laughing.
Sometimes in life, you block your blessings. Sometimes in life, you block
I'm
your
like,
blessings.
You know, and it's what I was saying. It's like, you know what? Like, black people here in Oregon apparently do not know how to differentiate between a white woman looking at them suspiciously versus a white woman looking at them with some very pleasant thoughts.
No,
like,
I
they haven't been
that's
trained.
He's probably an Atlanta transplant.
Yeah, that's a him issue right there. I don't know what's up with Buddy, but, yeah, Buddy, sometimes you block your blessings, man. I don't know what to say to that, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that either, Buddy mouth.
But there were other people around too, like the clerks at the customer service area, you know, because that's where the carts are usually and stuff. Like, there were other people that like overheard this and saw this, and they were laughing too. It's like, this dude just made a total ass out of himself.
Yeah, he did.
Appreciating you. Apparently you don't know the difference between somebody appreciating you and somebody scrutinizing you. You're an idiot, you know?
His friend is telling that story to this day at events, holidays, barbecues, cookouts, and everything. His friend is still telling that story to his
yes.
friend and still laughing. That's hilarious.
Yes, the reaction
well,
of his friend was awesome. He first fell on his knees laughing, and then he got back up, and then he, like, you know, punched, you know, the dude in the arm and was still laughing. You know that?
Thing.
You know,
nowadays,
like you punched the dude in the arm, like you just made a complete ass out of yourself kind of punching the arm. Yeah, that's what it was.
Nowadays you have more black males marrying white women.
In, girl.
And they get raked over the coal. Serena Williams married a white man. You should have heard the words that were said about her. So, you know, you just have those people in the country. I don't know. I think Nod is married to a Scandinavian. I'm not sure.
No, I'm still hoeing out here, sir. I'm not. No. Not me,
he is
man.
Enjoying his singlehood. And I understand.
I just have one thing to say. Hi, everybody,
yes.
by the way.
Hey.
I just had one thing to say about the differences between states and that kind of thing. It's not necessarily a racial difference in each region. I think it's an each region difference. Like, they do, the South is turning more north, by the way. But when I used to go to the South, I mean, everybody would stop and talk to you and say, hey, and, you know, I was a 14-year-old kid. I'm like, oh, hi, what are you doing stopping and talking to me? And I'm from Michigan. We'll say hi, but we don't want to stop and talk. We'll hold the door for you, but that's about it. So I think it's kind of a, you know, like the Midwest has certain ways that they do things, the East Coast, West Coast.
Yeah, but well, you're talking about cultural. You're talking about cultural capacity, how people act interpersonally. Like, people can be nice and whatever, but that has nothing to do with the outcomes as far as how dynamics play out in each state. Like, you can look these things up. It's, you know, it exists. All of the data is there. The things Pianki brought up tonight, like, I wouldn't doubt him on that. I haven't looked into what he said, but I wouldn't doubt him on those things. This is typically what happens in America. It is what it is. This is a problem that we've never solved. And we really have no interest in solving. So, you know, it still exists. That's kind of how it goes, man. If you got a problem in your bathroom, but you decide you're going to keep cleaning the kitchen, guess what? The bathroom's still going to be dirty.
I guess it's because my metropolitan area is Flint. And Flint is a smaller city, metropolitan city. And it's gotten smaller because, you know, GM left and it was, So I grew up having interracial couples was the norm. And so it's not like that big of a deal where I'm at unless there's a fight. So
well, in certain parts of the country, it was an experiment.
If I get in a fight with one of the girls that I work with, you know, and it's just, to me, it's just a screaming match, it's going to, you know, it's just going to turn out all out. Same thing if, you know, that they do the same thing in one of the towns closer to me and they pick on me and they start a fight with me, it's going to turn out all out on, you know, it's going to go by racial lines. Once blows are being thrown.
So one of you has a weave and the other does it?
Yeah, it would be best if both left, but yeah, sometimes that doesn't happen.
No, I said so one of you has a weave and the other doesn't.
Oh.
Not the other one has weaves.
Yeah.
The weave hair?
Hair's, yeah. What,
it's usually the first thing that come
fly,
off.
Girl.
Yeah, it's the first thing
off.
That's fly.
Yeah, you got earrings and you got your weave and the white girl's taking off her shoes and shit's gonna get real.
Oh yeah.
Right, but just the fact that that's considered the norm kind of lets you know, like, there's a idea that you have to assimilate, you have to figure out a different way, so that's why weaves are as popular as they are. The weave can be the difference between your class level, man. You can get a job here or you can get a job there if you throw that weave on. Like, it is what it is. It is what it is.
No, but also, no, it's the Jerry Springer reaction people have, you know, and so just be like, whoa.
That's the other part.
They're
Americans
crazy.
Are crazy. So that's the other part.
I don't care. I don't care what color you are, where you come from. Americans are crazy.
Yeah, Americans are crazy. But just think about what we're talking about. When people heard about the Flint water crisis, they assumed that Flint was majority black and all black. People didn't know that Flint was a big city.
No.
That was basically the old Midwest Rust Belt story. When industry left, people were still there. They had to make a living. They figured out a way to do it, whether they were working part-time somewhere and 40 hours somewhere else. They made a living and did what they had to do. Politicians sold them out, go to the emergency manager of Flint, who changed the water source and led to, you know, the crisis and everything else. But people assumed that this happened because there was all black people there. No, this was a mixed community, and they were willing to do it to them, too, because guess what? Whiteness is not a scientific thing. Whiteness is a social construct. Race is a social construct. Again, we go back to the Homo sapiens sapien thing. Humans are human. But in America, because of the racist foundation of America, we have these racial things that still exist that we haven't been able to get rid of. So, you know, they play out in different ways, and you see that. But, yeah, the story of Flint is amazing because people still to this day still don't understand. There's a lot of white folks there who were left out to dry, drinking bad water and everything else. But since we don't have class
but
conversation,
you know,
in America, people don't know.
The city of Flint used to be, just real quick, Pianki, the city of Flint used to be a I can't remember what it was called. It was a beacon. There were Japanese mayors that came over to tour the city of Flint because they did adult education. They did, it was a metropolitan area that made it a small town feel. So you want to go in after your work and you want to learn something at the community college, it was free. They had things going for the kids at all levels, and it was all free. And they had the best school system at the time. And then GM started going down and moving out. We still have some GM in the town. We have a few plants still in the town, but not like it used to be. So,
but Cinnamon, bring up NAFTA and GATT. NAFTA and the GATT treaty ship
NAFTA.
Parts across the world and then assemble them in America and say made in America on the box after you send it out, even though the majority of the labor you shipped overseas.
Hold on for a sec. They did. Okay, two things. One, when we got into the water system, the emergency manager that was put in place, that was not by vote. That was just Rick Snyder. That was his whole thing. That's why he's still on trial for this big thing, was because he was authoritarian on the whole thing. I run this country. That's it. Your city council, your mayor, nobody has any power. It's my people.
And my wife happens to work with Nestle, who wants that water that you have up here in Michigan. Yeah.
Oh, Lord. We keep fighting against that, and it wasn't Snyder. It was the one before him that gave them the okay to start pumping, and then Nestle keeps coming back. We got to pump a little more per hour. Can we do this? Can we do that? Can we do this? And then everybody's noticing the Great Lakes are going down. Oh, it's climate change. No, it's not. We are almost an island, and so it's sucking all our groundwater out.
Yeah,
how bad is the water?
We are literally shipping barges and barges and barges full of fresh water from the Great Lakes over to China.
China has
how
been
bad was the water in Flint? How bad was the water in Flint?
It was bad. They once they switched, all those chemicals started, because usually through a pipe, it builds up like this slime layer.
Yeah.
And the chemicals that they put in there cut through that slime layer and then started cutting into the iron. So first you're getting all this really dark brown, greenish guck coming out. And that was the first thing that we noticed was these people were going on YouTube going, this is what the hell is coming out of my pipes. And I'm telling my landlord, this is what they're doing in Flint, because my girlfriend on the other side of Flint, she's got the same thing, and it was bad. So it wasn't just because of the lead pipes. It was the caustic chemicals that took that safety barrier out first and started shooting that through the faucets, and then you got the rusty water afterwards. It was bad, very bad.
Well, you know, of course, after the chemical problem, but before that, you know, there's about 3,000 other cities had worse water per se than Flint in the country. Now
they have what we ended up with the lead leaking into the water, and so they had the rusty water coming in. And it's very prevalent across the country.
Actually, five other cities. I'm reading this report. It says there's five other cities that have worse water than Flint, water crisis. So, you know, it's a shame. It was a technical shame that occurred, but, you know, things like that happen.
They're going to get
I can tell you.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Cinnamon, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, all right, so coming from rural Alaska, where I live on the island, we started out with a population of about 60 people. And now we have a whopping probably 120 people year-round. And it doesn't sound like a lot, and we're not a lot of people, but we still matter. And we started out with the old logging camp infrastructure, so rudimentary pipes and septic systems and pump systems and whatnot. Well, our water has been failing the safe levels of testing. We have a groundwater source that's a watershed that goes into a tank that the tank is not equipped to capacitate a larger population like we have now. And we have these, like, the screens in my bath or in all my spigots and stuff, I have to take screens out constantly and take this muddy, slimy goo crap, and the water is all weird. And I won't even, like, boil the water for my family. And it's got all these harmful chemicals in it. And it's really sad because a lot of people where I live, not all of them, but some of them are on fixed incomes and reliant on, you know, seasonal work and whatnot because it's a very rural community. And they cannot afford to buy bottled water for their families. And I have been buying bottled water for months now, and or taking water from the mountain, you know, a fresh water source, and boiling it for my, you know, cooking with or washing dishes with. But it's sad because, I mean, we may not have the lead in it, but we've got all these other carcinogenics in it that, you know, the EPA tested for. And there's no money. There's no outcry. There's no nothing. And
you need to get a hold of somebody. And I'll tell you right now, it was Cher that brought the Flint crisis to the national attention.
Well, nobody cares.
She got mad.
A small community on an island.
No, contact Cher. I'm not kidding. She got really mad. She was because she told me. Oh, she didn't tell me. God. She did in the first interview that when she gets up, she looks at news. And she looks at news feeds from all around. And it popped up on one of her news feeds for Michigan that this was going on in Flint. And then so she researched it more. And she's like, no, we get. So she called it out nationally. And that's how everybody started rallying around to save Flint. So if you reach out to Cher, if she can't get the word out, she will probably send it to somebody else to get the word out.
What a sad state of affairs that Cher and Dolly Parton are probably
more effective
than the majority of politicians.
I know, but
I'm just saying, like, that's a real thing. Like,
I know, and it is sad, but I actually like that when it's out. When a celebrity turns around and says, we got to do something about this because it just slaps down the local politician.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it's so sad that, you know, the fact that children do not have safe, clean drinking water anywhere, you know, or not anywhere, but in the United States, period, whether it's one spot, two spots, or a major, you know, one child not having water is not enough, you know, is too many not having it. And it's a right that we all as Homo sapiens deserve.
You know, some people prefer to drink raw water. The numbers are bigger
than
you
think. I love raw
water.
No, I drink it. My husband likes me to boil it for the rest of the family, but I drink raw water. I think it's good for you.
Yeah, but this is where
I take it from a clean source.
Yeah,
you know,
this is where the conversation goes full circle. We were talking about private and public things earlier. So there's places that Pianchi was talking about who are having these water issues across country. Jackson, Mississippi is another one. We can go to Appalachia.
Uh-huh.
We can go all over Appalachia. You can find it. But when you get private industry in who has to make a profit, that's a different circumstance than a government who says this needs to run and the majority of our focus is on safety. But if you get a private
industry, and I've seen,
you know, I know y'all have seen it too. There are different states and different counties where it'll be on the ballot as a referendum where they say, hey, this company says they can provide better, cheaper, whatever, and if we just turn it over to them, things will be better. And yeah, well, of course, 5 years later, the city is is in terror and everybody wants to get rid of that private source and go back to the public source because the public source, somebody is accountable. There's a body to be kicked. Shout out to Thomas Jefferson when he brought up his, you know, refusal to accept the idea of corporations being the norm. He said, neither souls to be damned or bodies to be kicked. That is the danger of corporations, and you should be careful about who you give a charter to. Now, here we are all these years later where the idea of a corporation and a businessman are looked at as the epitome of Americanism. But if you talk to some of those old dead folks, so-called founding fathers, they weren't too They weren't too keen on the idea of corporate forces.
I know I'm the bad guy, Pianca. Don't say that. I had a corporation, so I was a good person.
No, not all corporations. I just don't want them ahead of, in front of essential services. So roads, water, you know, things that actually matter as far as the public good. We used to have something called the commons.
They're the ones that have to build those things, man.
Well, they don't have to. They would like
the
contract to
build,
but they don't have to.
Yeah, the contractors are the ones that have to bid. I like this.
Yeah,
you know, the bridges
I like to see the city do that. We're road builders. Who do you think paid us to build all the infrastructure here? The government or the state or the local tribes?
They pay for it, but they don't have the personnel to do it, is what I'm saying.
No, we had to supply it, and we had to supply the backbreaking work and dangerous conditions and made it happen. And that's where that comes together. But I do believe that, you know, there needs to be a safe infrastructure of, you know, healthy resources of air and water and whatnot.
You know, in I can speak well on Missouri. I'm pretty well sure other states are too, but they have a Department of Transportation, which has engineers that design roads, design bridges, and then they put those things out for bid to private corporations and companies to do the actual, provide the labor and the material to actually build the things. But they still have great input. They draw up the specifications that have to be followed. But
they have the inspector on the job.
They have the inspector on the job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and a punch list, and everything has to meet, you know, specification in order to get paid. And government contracts or state contracts are a huge headache for any contractor, you know. But it's a part. It's a patriotic duty. You have to accept and bid on those bids.
And it's something that the private companies want to do. You never will find a private company, for instance, building a levee. They leave that up to the Corps of Engineers because no company could face
that's
the
their
liability.
Job.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, look at the levees down in New Orleans.
Huh? Yeah, oh, my God. The insurance premiums would be ridiculous. Like, yeah, you don't want private stuff like that.
Yeah, they couldn't do no levy, but other things they can.
Well, that's why we had so much trouble with nuclear energy, honestly, because, you know, some people who are, you know, extra green and everything else, they don't understand that nuclear power could actually be the next phase that we go to as far as getting off of some of the, you know, carbon and oil and everything else. But they're so scared of nuclear power. And, of course, as Pianchi just laid out, you think about the difficulty of securing insurance and dealing with nuclear power as a private industry. My God, people remember Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, so it's really difficult to get done. But that's something that we're going to have to do.
But that's why nuclear power plants are usually, Well, you know, the nuclear power plants that you have around the country are privately owned, but they come under regulations by those boards that's pertaining to nuclear use of nuclear fuels and so forth. But the normal construction is just typical. I mean, that's typical. And you're right. I think the nuclear power is going to be called upon more in the future because it's, you know, look at ships. You can, a ship can sail on this nuclear power for a decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had that problem down here in Georgia.
Look at,
so Georgia Power created nuclear reactors, but they pre-charged all of the customers. So if you're, you know, in Georgia,
yeah,
you
I would guess that
an extra amount. And of course, they came with a bid. They said it would only cost $5 billion. We can get this done in 5 years. So of course, here we are. 15
it's right.
Years later. Exactly.
Like in Texas with Halliburton and the plant that they built there that they wanted to charge the public before it was even built. That's totally ridiculous. You don't have no control whatsoever.
Yep.
The price.
That's what they did here.
And some government officials had to get paid off.
You know, they're still working on that, the ITER, the fusion nuclear machine that they're building. There's like 35 countries working on it. And I know that the U.S. just pledged billions of dollars to this. And it's something they've been working on forever, and they don't even know if it's going to work. But it's that they're trying to imitate the power of the sun. And
that's also why the Saudis are so mad at us right now. The Saudis are pissed off.
Exactly.
And us exploring alternatives and green energy.
And through all of this, though, you know, Russia is still partners with this. And we are still working with Russian scientists. And they're saying that, you know, because I'm not going to buy into Ukraine stuff, but that greater good of man is better, you know, greater than politics. But you have Russia, China, India, Japan, European Union, you know, 35 countries total are working on this. And it is the meaning of the translation of the machine means the way in Latin. So this is the way for mankind, they believe, forward. And Some conspiracy theorists believe that, you know, we're the worker bees putting together a fission, you know, bomb for mankind and blah, blah, blah. But this is different than what we know from the past with nuclear energy, which I am a supporter of nuclear energy. I think that it's a good way forward. It's the only way forward. It's controllable, it's containable if we know more about it. But with this technology, there's less chance of melting down and more control and a smaller unit despite the huge, I mean, this reactor they're building is huge, just huge. But they can, you know, downsize this model. This is atoms they're working with. So I think this is really important to watch in the future and, you know, coming months and to see that everybody's working together. I don't know how I feel about it, but it is the highest, you know, promise of an energy source that's out there.
Well, you know, they
I would like to interject something here. We cannot forget about hemp. What about hemp?
Well, yeah. All right,
it is recently that one of the most powerful batteries is made out of hemp-based products. Why not hemp? It can grow just about everywhere. Nobody wants to look at hemp.
But nuclear fusion and hydrogen and stuff it's renewable within itself. It doesn't require manpower and land and erosion and water. And I, not that I'm not a supporter of hemp.
But actually, reduces erosion. Hemp reduces all of those things.
It's not an either or. It's an and. So you should have nuclear exploration. You should also have hemp exploration.
Everything
that takes away us pulling carbon out of the ground, because that causes the problems that people have to deal with. Anybody on here, go down to Biloxi, Mississippi, and eat a plate of shrimp. I dare you. That Gulf Horizon spill from years ago is still a factor in what you eat in the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, because these spills and, you know, these things that happen are so dangerous. She's in Alaska. She understands. When we had the Exxon Valdez spill and they sent the indigenous people out there with sponges and long brushes to clean up the oil there, the cancer that came later and the people that died off later, they had no idea what they were exposing themselves to. They just thought,
yeah,
hey,
they were just trying to help their community.
Clean this stuff up, right? We're gonna clean this stuff. They had no idea what they were dealing with. So,
yeah, but hey, let's just roll back a bit. They cleaned it up as a stopgap. They were there for hours or days. It wasn't. Right. It was left upon them to do it by themselves. When you live in rural communities like I do, and which I do live in a rural community like the spill happened in fact, a very much smaller community, when something happens, we're the first responders. Whether it is nuclear crap that is coming up from a tsunami in Japan on our beaches, and we are walking around, the government gave us Geiger counters to record the debris that washed up in my front yard. Okay.
My God.
So we were the first response.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So, Native people showed up to do it. Bad things happened to them. Who knows what's going to happen, when my kids were cleaning up stuff on the beach, you know, 20 years down the road or something. Health-wise, we were the first responders. We were the first ones to, like, go, the shit has to come off the beach. It's unsustainable for the ocean. And people came behind us and collected it and took it to containment facilities in the lower 48. So, bad things happen, and fossil fuels and nuclear reactors and windmills and wave mills and hydro dams and salmon. And I think it's just we're learning as we go along, as sad as it sounds. And I'm not making excuses for anybody, but we're just human. And fossil fuel was great while it lasted. We're learning about nuclear energy. It's taken us a while. And some of the other things, some things we found, wind works good for some places. It doesn't work well for others. Batteries work good. Levees work good for some places. And just moving whole communities works for others. There's a lot to that. I mean, I wonder if sometimes man lives where they shouldn't live. You know, how many hurricanes does it take to say, hey, maybe we should quit building the town here?
You
and
know, but I gotta say that is a testament to men's perseverance as well. Human perseverance, where we live in the most inhospitable places.
I know that
a heritage of Norwegian and Swedish. those are not warm countries, put it that way. And you know, it's just, you know, but we live there. We've done it through centuries. It's homes. It's,
I have to say that, I have friends in North Carolina, and it was, in the Outer Banks, and you couldn't build past, a certain point towards the water. You couldn't build right on the water. You couldn't build past a certain elevation. And a whole
that
bunch
is
of New
how
York
Oregon is, actually. The whole Oregon
yeah.
coast is public. And there are limits as far as, like, the distance between the shore and the property you can own and stuff all along the Oregon coast.
It wasn't about privacy of beaches. They, because they're right there on the coast, they were always a hurricane trouble spot. And so, but a whole bunch of New York money wanted to move to North Carolina, and they kept bugging all the little local towns. And they said, okay, you can build. And then I can't remember what was the big one that hit North Carolina? I can't remember the name.
Katrina?
But it...
I think it was before Katrina. I want to say it was Alexander, George, Mike. One of them.
So everything got wiped out, and everything that they had said normally you couldn't build up to, everything past that survived. They had damage, but it wasn't wiped out completely. So they told insurance came in and paid for everybody's house. Everything was going to be rebuilt. They rebuilt. They got hit by another hurricane, but it wasn't as catastrophic. And North Carolina, the insurance company said, okay, we're not going to cover you again. And North Carolina told them, no. You can build again if you want to, but your house gets destroyed, goes into the sea, we're going to charge you for cleanup. And they finally stopped building in those areas.
Good.
So, yeah. People get stupid and they want to live someplace that's not – there's a reason if you go to a certain area and you don't know the area and a whole bunch of people are not living there, there's usually a very good reason. We hit 9 billion
yes.
humans.
Well,
so,
Cinnamon. So, I have a home. I have a home over in Sitka, where my son goes to school. Because on the island, if we don't have 10 kids, we don't get a teacher. They won't send a teacher for our school. So, but he's in high school. He needs to be going to a real school. But over on Baranof Island, where Sitka, Alaska is, they had a couple landslides, and one of them took out a home that was being built, and a couple of locals got killed, and it was just catastrophic, just so sad. And they put this huge moratorium on about 40% of the real estate in Sitka. It was on this hillside that it was in this landslide zone. And they're doing this in Juneau right now, too. And all of the insurance companies said, hey, we're not going to cover these houses. We can't. It's a huge liability. National, you know, geologists said blah, blah, blah. You know, state said blah, blah, blah. So anybody that had a home loan, a bank loan, were in risk of losing their home. And when all these people say, hey, we're going to lose our homes because we can't insure them and the banks won't carry the contracts, the Sitka Borough, knowing the dangers, went ahead and reversed their moratorium to appease the banks in the interest of, you know, against the best interest of these people's safety. And it's really sad that they would pick it, like availability of real estate available, and you know I don't want anybody to lose their home. That is just as it. But losing your life and living in constant fear and being stuck in this bank loan on the side of a mountain is wrong in so many ways. And it's sad, and it's kind of like what those people in North Carolina You know, there was a reason they weren't building there. And years ago, people should have known that they shouldn't have built what they built. But they allowed these people to build on the house side or hillside. People died.
Because they wanted the money.
And then now people are going to die again because the banks want their money. But at the same time, I don't want to sound like an ass. I don't want all these people to lose their homes either. But it's sad because there's all these people living in uncertainty. Anytime it rains, anytime that we have a typhoon, they're like, oh, my gosh, is this the one? Or one of our several earthquakes we're always having, you know, oh, is this the one? So, yeah, no, banks and financial interest over the safety and well-being of people. It goes beyond, property.
Bush started the FEMA hurricane fund, and it was the flooding.
Yeah.
Is what it is. And it only covers flooding. So if your house gets knocked off its foundations, it'll cover it. But if your house just gets flooded and, you know, comes up to the halfway up the first floor walls, it's not going to cover that. My mom has to pay for that. And my mom has to pay $600 a year over atop her regular insurance for her homeowners. And it's because she lives by a creek. And I'm not kidding you, this creek is only like a foot and a half deep. Has big, long banks, and it's one of the tributaries from the Flint River, considered one of the 100-year
flood zones.
Drought flood zones. And she, but she is not on, she doesn't have a basement. They won't, originally when the house was built, she couldn't put a basement. They couldn't put a basement in because it was a flood zone. And they had a parcel across the street that was there for the flood zone. And so she's still paying $600 a year extra. And it's never going to wash her house off its foundation because she's got a crawl space. And she tried to fight it. She tried to fight it. She said, I'm paying for the stupid asses in New York, the stupid asses in Florida, and the stupid asses in North Carolina.
And Oregon.
Well, my elementary school teacher, she sat us down. She got on the piano. And she said, you load 16 tons, and what do you get? For those who know that song, they understand what I'm talking about.
Yep, another day over and deeper in debt.
Indeed. So at a certain point, we have to say enough. No more.
Yeah.
That's just what it
Sometimes
is.
Sometimes I have to say that that's my go-to phrase for the government screwing up is Bush saying and tapping the FEMA director on the back. Good job, Brownie. And that was just so perfect.
I'll never forget that. And then we get the emails from the execs telling him to roll his sleeves up. So he seems like he's working hard during the situation. Like, yeah, that was something. But I got to go. It was good talking with y'all tonight. But I do got to ask one question before I go. If Ukraine is able to survive this war and keep their sovereignty as a nation, the next president of Ukraine and the debt that they will owe to the United States, how are they going to actually have a functional government? I'm just asking.
Well, it won't be functional because we are going to dictate it, and no government has been functional that the United States has dictated. Put it that way.
I got a better one.
I'll say every time we send money over to Ukraine, just for a second, Pianki, it was never as a loan. It was always as aid. So, right there.
Yeah, now, you might want to check the fine print on that.
why don't you just go?
All right, I'll go, man. Y'all have a good one.
You have a nice
evening,
man.
Especially if they join aid They join NATO.
Good night, Naj. Thank you.
Good night.
Take care.
Thanks so much for calling in. It's been a great time with you.
Good night, kids.
Good night.
Donnie. Hey, Donnie. What you doing?
He turned around and walked away. We've been having trouble with our little guy sleeping all night, so both of us are extra exhausted. We're doing rotations. That's the one bad thing about this. Don knows about this because he had 3 kids. I don't know. I had stepkids. So I got to tell you, doing the rotation and not sleeping with the hot flashes and the menopause, it's not a good thing. Sorry, Pianki.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, honestly. You know, I had a 21-day cycle.
Hey!
So, yeah, only 2 weeks and then back again. So I totally get it, Finn. I said it before, I'll say it again. Round and around and around we go. Where my cycle stops and starts, nobody knows.
That ought to be just terrible.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Oh, Lord.
Be glad you're a man. Well, if I am if there is such a thing as reincarnation, please do not make me a woman again. Cause,
you know what's causing that, don't you?
Oh, I'm okay
that
with
big
that.
A big four
ahead,
moon we had the last few weeks.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
the
blood
red
moon.
Which is also the Hunter moon. But because we had the eclipse, it was a...
The gravitational pull is the reason.
Yeah, speaking of Hunter moon, you guys, I'm going to get up early and go hunting. So we're going to wrap this up.
Hunting for what?
Yeah,
what are you hunting?
Deer.
What you
hunting?
Luck hunting. Deer? Okay.
Yeah, Sitka blacktail.
Well, good luck.
It's that
and
time of year. Time to fill up the freezer. Yeah, got to beat the wolves to it.
There you go, girl.
Yep. All right, everybody. I want to thank everybody for calling in tonight, and Pianki and Cinnamon, Donnie and Lorianne, and Naj for calling in. Yeah, you know, I love to hear, you know, everybody's opinion on stuff, and whether you're left or right or libertarian and stuff, that's what makes talk radio essential, and that's where the real conversations happen, you know, not on TV or, you know, in political circles. It's amongst people like ourselves. We have different opinions and at different parts of the country, and I think it's important.
And if you don't mind, I will say, listen to Beyond the Mainstream Saturday night, tomorrow night, Donnie C.
Yes, Saturday
on
night.
Blog Talk Radio, 6 to 9 p.m., but we often go into overtime. That's Pacific time, 9 p.m. to whenever, Eastern time.
Yeah.
on Saturday nights. You know, I usually call in, Pianki does. That's become a regular. And then my show, of course, Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne, Sunday night, 6 to 9 p.m., goes into overtime, Pacific time. So, most of us will talk with each other tomorrow night. Dahl, you're always invited to call in. If you have a chance to breathe,
I will.
And you want to call in to be on the mainstream tomorrow, you certainly can. Hopefully you can make it Sunday, but I will understand if you don't.
I'll be there.
Okay, if you're sure, but I know you've got so much crap going on, so I understand you can't make it.
I'll make sure I get a deer tomorrow and get all my wood chopped. I'll be ready for Sunday.
Does a wood chop chop with a wood chop chop if doll is chopping, 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 chopping?
Yep.
I think it was how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Could chuck wood. Yeah. All right, everybody.
Yeah, that.
Well, we're signing out. Thank you so much, everybody. And this is Dahl Arnson with the Alaska Patriot Network. Thank you for listening. God bless you. God bless America. And we are signing out. Good night.
Good night.